This podcast was made on the lands of the Wurundjeri people, the Wurrung and the Boonwurrung. We'd like to pay respects to their elders, past and present, and emerging. From the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne, this is Psych Talks.
Hi there, and welcome to Psych Talks, where we look under the hood of some of the latest research in psychology. We chat to experts here at the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences about their discoveries and what these insights might mean for you or your family or friends. I'm Associate Professor Cassie Haywood, and I'm joined by my co-host, Professor Nick Haslam.
Hi, Cassie. So last time we talked about just how powerful new generation social media algorithms have become at knowing us. And we wanted to revisit social media again, but this time we're delving into content warnings or trigger warnings. In some way, these warnings have become almost mandatory when it comes to sharing material that may upset people. But have you ever stopped to wonder about whether these warnings actually work? Do they A, stop people looking at this upsetting stuff in the first place, and B, help them to feel less upset if they actually see it?
Or, as we'll discuss today, can they actually backfire? To shine a light on this, we're joined by Dr. Ella Moek, who specialises in the interplay between cognition and emotion.
Ella, welcome to the show. Delighted to be able to talk to you today. Can you tell us a bit about your work on future-oriented emotions and emotion regulation as a sort of backup and scene setting before we get into trigger warnings?
Yeah, for sure. And thank you so much for having me. My pleasure to be here. So broadly, my research kind of focuses on how our emotions influence the way we think about the past and the future. And I think I find anticipated emotions or emotions about future experiences particularly fascinating because it seems to be like they're the ones that people have the most trouble dealing with. I'm very interested in kind of characterizing those and also understanding how we can help people manage them through emotion regulation.
So what is emotion regulation?
Yeah, so emotion regulation are the ways that people try and change or maintain their emotions. So various strategies that people use. For example, maybe you're in a bad mood and you want to put on your favourite episode of Friends to distract yourself from that mood. That would be an example of emotion regulation.
Couldn't that make it worse?
Depends which episode you choose, I guess.
Ella, what are trigger warnings? And I know we'll talk more about how that relates to anticipatory emotions, but can you just give us a little bit of a definition of a trigger warning and what it is and how they've come to be?
Yeah, so trigger warnings are actually quite tricky to define. Merriam-Webster apparently defines it as a statement at the start of a piece of writing or video or image that alerts the person to the fact that it might contain distressing material. And that's kind of the way that I think most of us think about them. But for a more scientific definition, it's kind of any statement that intends to help someone to either avoid content that's likely to trigger them to think of a past experience or to trigger like negative emotions related to their past experience.
So people probably recognize them from content on social media. Where else do we typically see trigger warnings?
Yeah, so these days we see them in a lot of places. Social media is a big one. There's the social media companies now have their own kind of trigger warning systems like sensitive content screens on Instagram. But we also commonly see them on our TV before, even in the news, on the radio, Netflix, when you go and watch a movie, and also in the education domain. So in the 2010s, they really sprung onto the scene of college campuses. So a recent study actually found that over half of US college professors felt inclined to use a trigger warning or did use a trigger warning on their content.
And so what benefits are they intended to have? And we can talk about their actual impact, but what's the intention behind a trigger warning?
So trigger warnings are proposed to have two main benefits. The first is to allow people to avoid content that they don't want to see. So by knowing that it's coming up, you can make a decision to, say, turn off the news bulletin. The second proposed benefit is that they allow people to emotionally prepare for seeing that content. So by being warned about it, the idea is that you can then kind of engage in emotion regulation strategies that you know help you. If you then either have to view the content or you want to view the content, that kind of thing. So they're the two benefits they're proposed to have.
So where did this idea come from? So you've said that it's sort of taken off in the last decade or so, but has it got a deeper history than that?
Yeah. So trigger warnings themselves actually date back to the 1990s, and they first appeared on feminist messaging forums, and they started quite simple. It would simply say at the top of a post, trigger warning. And it was usually to alert readers to content around sexual assault and other types of trauma. So the kind of origins comes from the literature on post-traumatic stress disorder and this idea that when you encounter something that reminds you of your trauma, it can elicit what's called re-experiencing symptoms. So this includes things like thinking about the event, experiencing the same emotions you had when that event occurred, and up to as extreme as having flashbacks about the event as well. So, that's kind of where they first appeared, was on these feminist messaging boards. And then in the early 2000s, they started to appear on other internet sites like Tumblr. Facebook, I think, was around the late 2008. There we go. And on Twitter around those same time. Yeah.
So it sounds like one of the things that's happened is the idea has evolved. So you mentioned how it started off with a fairly narrow meaning to do with trauma and assault. The impression I get is that over time it's broadened to cover a whole range of more objectionable sorts of things. Is that true?
Yeah, that's definitely true. The first warnings also used to appear commonly on like self-harm and suicide content. So those kind of things. But now it's pretty much anything that anyone decides might be remotely distressing, which of course is just impossible to ever constrain. And I think that's why we've really seen this kind of creep of trigger warnings into so many different domains.
So is distress the idea that trigger warnings are meant to be avoiding or dampening or preparing you for, or is it specifically, or was it specifically anxiety or anxiety-related emotion? Because it seems like some of the things we now have trigger warnings for are more upsetting in a moral way, sort of generate moral outrage, or they're upsetting it for reasons other than personal anxiety or personal trauma. Again, is that more or less correct?
Yeah, I would say that's more or less correct. I think distress is kind of a catch-all term for any kind of negative emotion that people might experience when they view content that may be those kind of prototypical traumatic event related, but could also just be something like discrimination. We often see it on now, oppression. Yeah, even like very historical events will be preceded by trigger warnings. So,
and I guess that's probably what makes this so hard to talk about or challenging to talk about, because it does seem to get sucked into this culture war polarization between people who talk about snowflakes on the other hand versus those who really want to be protecting people, vulnerable people especially, from the ill effects of gratuitous content. What's your feeling about the whole way in which this seems to have been politicized?
Yeah, so I think in the 2010s it just became absolutely part of the culture war. And we kind of developed these two camps, the people who are pro-warnings and see it as, you know, an important part of being respectful or advocates for people's mental health. And then the anti-trigger warning camp, which are, you know, people who see them as coddling and as overprotective. And also, I think, important to note about that camp is that you know, one of the key things that trigger warnings intend to do is allow people to avoid content, but avoiding content actually goes against the like therapeutic advice for post-traumatic stress disorder. It's not always helpful to be avoiding things that remind you of your traumatic event. That's a key claim that the anti-trigger warning people make. But these camps very much developed before we had any kind of empirical evidence on the topic.
And do we have better empirical evidence now?
Yeah. So it was around 2018 that the first kind of empirical studies on trigger warnings and their effectiveness really started to emerge. Yeah. So we've got now 5 years of research on this topic, and there's been a really great increase in kind of the prevalence of the research.
And what are the main findings out of the research? And I know there's been a recent meta-analysis. Is that a useful way to think about the where the empirical research sits at the moment?
Yeah, so the meta-analysis that was recently led by Dr. Victoria Bridgeland, it focused on kind of synthesizing the studies that have been conducted to date, but focusing particularly on kind of the experiments that have been conducted. So studies that have compared giving people a trigger warning to giving them no warning and then exposing them to the same content and seeing how having a warning versus no warning impacts those two proposed benefits of the trigger warning. So does having a warning make people more likely to avoid content, and does it change the way that they respond to the content?
And what were the findings from that research?
So the meta-analysis focused on 12 studies that have been conducted to date. And what they found was that if we first look at the two proposed benefits, when people are exposed to a warning relative to no warning, it actually has no effect on how likely they are to avoid content. So it doesn't make people more likely to avoid, nor does it make them less likely to avoid. There is no strong evidence kind of sit in the middle. And if we turn to the second proposed benefit of trigger warnings, which, as a reminder, is to allow people to emotionally prepare for the content, the idea being that if you're more emotionally prepared, you should be less affected by the content, they also found no evidence for this idea. So when people saw the content and they either saw a warning or no warning, there was no difference in the emotional responses to that content between those two groups.
And just to clarify, so a meta-analysis is a synthesis of a whole bunch of research projects that have been completed. So in many ways, this is kind of a gold standard of looking at whether those effects of trigger warnings actually play out. And you're saying that they kind of don't.
Yes, it is the gold standard. And, you know, although it was only 12 studies, what they do is they take every effect size from those studies. So there's, for the emotional responses to content, they analysed 86 different effect sizes. So it's quite a good estimate, particularly for that question. I think that's our best estimate, is that they do nothing. So they neither make people feel worse, nor do they make them feel better.
And was this on a range of different types of content or places where people would see trigger warnings?
Yeah, so this is mostly images and films and text passages. Mm-hmm. A lot of the research has been conducted using online studies. So there is that kind of caveat to it. But yeah, it was over a range of content, both neutral content or ambiguous content, as well as negative content itself. And the authors also looked at kind of, are trigger warnings perhaps having some unintended consequences? So there's these two benefits. We've got not really much evidence for either of those. But is it possible that they're actually creating some harms themselves? And one way that they looked at this was by looking at people's anticipatory emotions. So how did they feel when they saw the warning before they saw the content? And here we do find some evidence that trigger warnings are actually creating anticipatory anxiety and making people feel distressed when they encounter a warning. And this is across both kind of self-reported measures, so right now how distressed you feel, as well as physiological measures like heart rate and, you know, people feeling sweaty, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle, is to consider, you know, we don't have evidence for the benefits, but we also are perhaps creating a negative effect that wouldn't have otherwise been there.
And that negative effect would be all right, wouldn't it, if it was balanced by a positive effect afterwards? But the point is, it isn't. So it's preparation which is making you more anxious or miserable without any longer term benefit.
Yes, that's right. And one of the ideas behind trigger warnings is that, you know, you might be creating this anticipatory anxiety, but then that could be offset when things aren't as bad as you thought they would be, and then you end up feeling better. But we don't really see that kind of evidence for this idea that bracing for the worst by expecting the bad content is a helpful thing to be doing.
Is that a more general truth? I mean, getting off the topic of trigger warnings briefly, I mean, I know people say one strategy when you're facing the future is defensive pessimism. You know, expect the worst and you'll be protected from bad things happening. You'll never be disappointed. I mean, that's not a great strategy either, is it?
No. And some work that research that I've been involved in, we've been looking at this idea more generally. And what we find in our studies, in one particular study, we followed students who were waiting for exam results. And we found that the students who felt more negative in anticipation of getting their grades felt worse once they got their grades. So there's no real evidence broader than trigger warnings that there's these kind of bounce back effects. So if you're someone who likes to brace for the worst, I suggest you think twice about it.
I'm still really surprised by that idea that the research findings that you spoke about, and I think it will surprise others as well, that not only does the trigger warning not seem to work, but even before they see the content that was supposed to be triggering for them, they're already feeling worse just by reading the trigger warning. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I think even the term now, trigger warning, like you don't even need to see it in full. You can just see TW capitalized and you know straight away what that is referring to. I think the term itself has kind of taken on a meaning of its own. And I think we can probably all relate to the experience of seeing that written and going, ooh, what am I going to see? Like it's very immediate to have this kind of anxious response.
And it taps into that kind of desire that we have to see something that's maybe not allowed or edgy or whatever. It's almost making it more kind of desired from us to see that content.
Yeah. So this is what's known as the forbidden fruit effect. So when something is preceded by a warning or is kind of off limits in a way, we want to see it more. And we see this in particular in the social media domain. Yeah. So some work that wasn't included in the meta-analysis because it's just come out, some really great work being led by Erin Simister looking at Instagram's sensitive content screens. And for those who aren't aware what they look like, they're essentially a blurred version of whatever negative image they're trying to screen. And then overlaid with that is the text, sensitive content. This photo may contain graphic or violent content. Now, that is a very ambiguous kind of statement. And paired with the blurred image, it just piques our curiosity. And we want to uncover, which is what's known as the Pandora box effect. And what these studies have shown is that over 80% of people either say they would uncover or when actually given the opportunity to do uncover these images. So I think this is kind of an extreme case of a trigger warning, but one that really like amplifies this tendency
to
want to see it.
Kind of the social media companies can say, oh, we put these warnings out, but if anything, it's making it more likely that people are actually going through and looking at that content.
Yes, that is what the current studies are suggesting,
Ella, on those social media posts, which people are probably familiar with seeing the blurred out content, who decides that that post needs the blurred out trigger warning screen? Is it the user who's posting it or is it the social media company itself saying this is a post that has been flagged and is now blurred out?
It's the social media company themselves. So a lot of the big social media companies, including Facebook, Instagram, I guess Meta is their broader company, they have content moderators. So content moderators are a pool of workers who spend hours every day going through the things that people are posting and deciding does this violate guidelines, in which case it should be taken down. So then you would see the post removed. Or is it doesn't violate guidelines, but we should flag it. And that they're the ones that get overlaid with the sensitive content screen. And then, of course, the other option is that it just stays up as it is. So, yeah, it's people, it's AI a little bit, but not entirely. There are, these huge bodies of workers making these decisions.
Ella, just to clarify, so we're talking about trigger warnings, specific content warnings around things that people might see. But how is that different to, you know, sitting down to watch a movie and you have a rating system, this isn't appropriate for kids under 15 or whatever those age limits are on different rating classifications. How are trigger warnings different to those rating classification systems?
So the rating classification systems have been around since the 1960s, so they're, you know, very well established. And I think, I don't know too much about the rating classification system, but I think they're much more legislated and you have to use them in like a set way. And there's very clear guidelines, I think, around what gets a certain rating, whereas we don't really have that yet for trigger warnings. And I think it's like very much up to the person adding the warning.
Was the idea, though, there with the rating systems, is it so much that we're concerned that children will be distressed by the content that they might see, or is it more just we think it'll be bad for them?
Yeah, I think the rating systems is more like deeming something inappropriate for a certain age group rather than kind of making a judgment about distress.
But going back, I mean, Cassie said it is surprising, these findings. I mean, the meta-analysis is very solid and you described it really clearly. But I think it is still a surprise to many of us that this would come out, because it's so intuitive that, you know, you prepare something, someone for some bad thing that's going to happen, they will cope with it better. I mean, why do we have this common sense? Is it because psychologists have taught us that these sorts of things ought to work, or is it some other reason?
Yeah, so I think what is a key driver of the effects, particularly in terms of the lack of effect on emotions, is that people see these warnings. We think that it's going to allow them to kind of bring up some coping strategies to help themselves. But in actual fact, very few people have these strategies on hand or know how to use them. And I think that's what we're seeing here, is like there's this assumption that you will do something to help yourself, but in actual fact, most people don't. And in one study, participants were asked to imagine that they encountered a trigger warning for their most negative life event, and asked, what would you do in this scenario? And there was very, very few of them who said anything to do with coping strategies. Most people said something like, I don't know. So, yeah, I think the assumption that people have kind of tools ready to whip out and use is a little bit misguided.
But are there effective tools? I mean, are people just not coming up with them because basically there's not much we can do as human beings? We just have to face stuff?
Yeah, so there are a wide range of effective tools and skills, and that's where the emotion regulation literature comes in. So we know from decades of research that there are things that people can do, and one promising avenue then is going, okay, well, what if we give people the tools? What if we teach them how to use emotion regulation on these kind of warnings, whatever form they're in? Might that be effective? This is actually something that I have started to be doing with some collaborators at Flinders University, and we are seeing really promising results. So what we have done in the first instance is got the sensitive content screens that Instagram uses and adding to them a instruction for how someone could use an emotion regulation strategy. So we trained our participants in two strategies: distraction, so shifting your attention to something else other than what you're viewing, and reappraisal, so seeing the content from a slightly different perspective. For example, you could imagine that the image that you're seeing is a faked image. And what we found is that when participants saw the warning screen with the instruction to use an emotion regulation strategy, their distress levels lowered relative to when they just saw the warning screen alone. And we just replicated these findings yesterday. Actually, we found out that they replicated when we taught one group of participants how to use distraction and the other group nothing. We found a very large effect of distraction in terms of decreasing their distress.
And it doesn't sound like that took too much effort to train them in that technique.
No. So this, they did, I mean, important to note that they did receive some training. And I think the challenge now will be going, okay, well, how can we make this something that people don't need training in because, you know, the likelihood of being able to do that at a large scale is quite low. But I think that's what makes something like distraction particularly promising and why we're focusing on that strategy is because, you know, it's pretty easy to tell someone to, you know, shift their attention slightly away or, you know, keep scrolling, like something that we often all do. But, you know, maybe something that simple could help make these screens more effective if the social media giants insist on continuing to use them.
So, I mean, distraction is great. I mean, I think it's often thought of as being a pretty primitive way of dealing with things, but it's effective, right? So why can't people figure it out for themselves? Why do they need to be trained to distract themselves? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it is, it's a surprisingly beneficial strategy, really, but perhaps people aren't thinking of it as something that would help. I also think sometimes it gets a bit of a bad rap and it's seen more like avoidance. So perhaps people shy away from it for that reason. Yeah, but I'm not too sure.
So going back to the meta-analysis, even if it seems to show that there are no real benefits on average and maybe a bit of a cost in terms of anticipatory anxiety, might it not be, or might they not be beneficial for at least some people or in some settings? So for instance, maybe they're not beneficial for most people, but maybe just for those with PTSD, they're terrific. And so you might still want to persist with trigger warnings in order to protect, if you like, the whatever percent of people who've been traumatized. Is there any merit to that argument?
I think we will, even with all this research, we will never be able to say that warnings aren't going to be beneficial for someone in some setting. That's really important to keep in mind, that what we're focusing here is on average effects. But the studies that have looked at vulnerable people, people who have been exposed to traumas, but also traumas that match the content of the trigger warning, there's very little evidence that they kind of act any differently, behave any differently, and even some evidence that they may be more likely to approach the content as well. And there was one study that found that trigger warnings actually kind of reinforce the idea that your trauma is central to your identity if you're someone who has PTSD. And I think something else that's really useful to consider is that, like, it's not just traditionally negative content that might trigger someone. It could be something that we all see as completely neutral. But for someone who's perhaps gone through a sexual assault, even smelling something that is remotely similar could trigger them. And we're not ever going to be able to put trigger warnings on everything when it could be such a wide range of content.
It's great we have this big body of research now, or growing body of research now, and this meta-analysis that summarizes it all for us. But in the end, it's still just 12 studies, right? So what are the new directions that research needs to take to advance the field?
Yeah, so the meta-analysis was on the 12 studies. There's since been quite a lot of stuff coming out around social media and Instagram sensitive content screens because they were only put in place in 2017, so quite a recent initiative. But yeah, there's a lot more important questions to answer. I think we know very little about the effects of different types of warnings. So trigger warnings can take lots of different forms. It can just be the word trigger warning. It can be trigger warning and the type of content, or it can specify how people will react. So an example would be this content may be distressing for some viewers. So there you've got a particular emotional reaction. It can specify which groups it might be bad for. And then even go so far to specify how people should respond. So in one example, I think it was in an art gallery or a museum, it said you can exit toward the left. So trigger warnings can be any combination or just one of those things. And so they vary vastly in terms of how vague they are and how specific they can be. And there's really not been much research looking at, well, what are the effects of different combinations of these things? Besides one study that used the sensitive content screens and then provided people a description of what the image was that was blurred. And they found that providing people a bit more detail led them to uncover quite a bit less. So suggesting that there might be something there about giving a little bit more detail rather than just the vague kind of statements. But yeah, in general, warning type is something that we need to know a lot more about, I think. And then, yeah, what I touched on before of if social media platforms insist on using these, and they likely will because there's now laws around it, then how can we make them a little bit better? And I think that's where the emotion regulation studies might come in. And lastly, almost all the research has been done online or in labs. And I think we really need to get out in the real world. We've got the ability now through people's smartphones to be asking them how they're feeling as they may be encountering negative content, trigger warnings, that kind of thing. And so, for example, I think, you know, testing the effectiveness of trigger warnings in a real environment, like in a museum or something, would be a really great study to be doing. And also looking more at like the longer term effects. So everything so far has been immediately warning content, but maybe there's something to be understood by seeing how this affects people over time.
Ella, I saw some memes recently around the Oppenheimer movie with teenagers saying this needed a trigger warning to remind me that this sex scene was going to be uncomfortable to watch with my parents. So that might be another type of trigger warning that you can look at.
Yeah.
Speaking of museums, I vaguely remember some study that looked at trigger warnings with people looking at art and how it somehow reduced aesthetic appreciation or something like that. Is that, did I hallucinate that study or is it real?
No, that's a real study. It's just come out a couple of months ago. And yeah, they found, so I think maybe for the first time, trigger warnings were having an impact on people's responses to the warned content. And in this case, yeah, reduce their appreciation of the art. So this could include things like how well done it is, the brush strokes, like, you know, all those kind of, I don't know too much about all the art words, but the general appreciation of the artwork. And I think that's because, like, by saying what it's depicting, you're kind of taking people's ability to just like imagine things about it or to appreciate it, because, you know, if you're told that it's depicting some kind of sexual assault, you're probably not going to think so kindly on the artist than if you were able to kind of enjoy that.
So Ella, should we stop using trigger warnings? Should we use them only in some situations? And for those of us who work in education, should we avoid using them in lecture theatres at university or in schools? I know there's a lot there to unpack, but if you want to walk through some of those examples.
Yeah, So, university campuses are a place where they are used a lot and there is a lot of pressure from students to use them. There was a survey done that found that 86% of UK students wanted to see trigger warnings in the classroom. So I think we're under quite a lot of pressure to be using them. But I think we should be resisting this pressure, particularly in terms of kind of slapping a trigger warning onto anything that could be remotely distressing for someone in your classroom when there's a potential harm that could go with using that. So it's not just that they're not achieving what they intend, but they could be making your students more anxious when they may not need to be. So I think, you know, as educators, but in general, when we're posting on social media, perhaps you feel inclined to put a trigger warning, you should think twice about what it is you're trying to achieve. So is it that you're trying to signal that you care about mental health? Is it that you're trying to be seen as a good person? You know, these are kind of motivations that we don't really want to consider in ourselves, but very much drive people to engage in this behaviour. And if it's because you want to, you know, achieve the commendable aims that trigger warnings have, then what are some other ways that you could do that? Or what are some things that you could do as well as just having a warning if you do want to have one? So, for example, is it if you're using a trigger warning, is it perhaps stopping you from engaging in conversations with your students about why some people are more distressed by certain topics than others? Or, you know, stopping you from giving helpful strategies or actually perhaps teaching your students what's something they could do if they go home and they're feeling a little unsettled by the content? And I think more practically, just being upfront with your students, perhaps in your syllabus or in the course description, exactly what kinds of topics are going to be discussed. So I think it's important not to say these may make you feel distressed, but rather just give a simple list of the kind of topics, and then they can make a decision for themselves if they want to enroll in that course. And then, you know, not giving these constant reminders through the semester.
So Ella, I want your personal help on this. So I teach a lot in the Master of Applied Psychology, where we're doing a lot of content around behaviour change strategies. But to do that, we look at advertisements that look at road safety issues. So we're looking at traffic accidents. We're looking at health messages around cancer. We're looking at how to get people to eat healthier, how to exercise, all these sorts of things, which all could be and have been, you know, students say, I think we need a trigger warning on this content. But how to say in those instances where pretty much everything in our course could typically be defined as a trigger warning relevant topic, how do we broach that with students and say, we're going to be covering a lot of sensitive topics, and do I just list them all? Or how do I approach that with students?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we have a set, like, this is the gold standard way, but I think, you know, certainly listing the topics in a very neutral way would be a good place to start. And, you know, so they know that information up front, doesn't catch them off guard. And then, you know, we could use it as an opportunity to actually explain why we're not going to be using a trigger warning, and then use that as an opportunity to educate them about that. Or, you know, providing a list of resources or places they can learn about emotion regulation strategies, either in the syllabus or at the end of the lecture, that kind of thing.
I mean, a lot of this stuff seems to hinge on the extent to which educational institutions should be caring about the mental health of students. At some level, of course, we should. Of course, we need to be concerned about their welfare, not just their education. But is there a chance that we sort of go too far and try to be too therapeutic and try to anticipate mental health costs in ways that might endanger the way we teach challenging material, like what Cassie was saying?
Yeah, definitely. I think the trigger warning debate is a prime example of this. And, you know, there's other things, like, I'm not sure how much it happens here, but certainly in the US, with content itself being censored and, you know, students no longer having the opportunity to learn about challenging topics. And then I think that brings up the question of, if we're so scared to educate about certain topics, then are they really getting the education that they deserve when coming to university?
And I think that's part of coming to university and even going through school as well, is learning how to deal with and talk about challenging topics rather than just saying, we can't talk about this.
Yes, definitely.
But in terms of the tools your own research is helping to establish as being effective, like distraction, I mean, is there a role for some sort of education about that at universities or schools? You know, obviously not turning them into CBT institutions, but, you know, cognitive behaviour therapy, sorry. but, you know, if that's one of the things that would help students deal with challenging things, maybe we ought to tell them, A, trigger warnings don't work, and B, here's something that does work.
Yeah, and I think especially in the digital age, like, we're, as a collective, facing this challenge now of negative content is far more available now than it ever was before. And that's a challenge that I don't think we're yet kind of equipped to deal with. And, you know, talking to students about digital literacy and what to do when you do encounter something that may upset you, because it's kind of inevitable that they will. And whether that's taking the form of teaching them about emotion regulation, which I think would be great, especially in schools, or whether it's something else, I think, yeah, we do need to turn our attention to kind of accepting this and then going, okay, what's the evidence-based things that we can do? And, you know, not just putting a warning on it, assuming people will have those skills themselves, because it doesn't seem like they do.
And to your point around the availability of negative content, that also might be playing into a reason why trigger warnings aren't having any impact either, because people are seeing stuff that they've told is going to be distressing, but it's actually not as bad as other stuff they've seen that doesn't have a warning, and then they're kind of not distressed and the trigger warning isn't doing anything. So I think that desensitization idea as well is interesting in terms of why trigger warnings might not, especially with younger generations who kind of see everything on social media.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think there is this kind of dilution and this potential mismatch sometimes for you. Like if you think, oh, it's going to be really bad, it's not that bad, then you might not take the next warning so seriously. And then, you know, it's just a big kind of muddle of how should I really set up my expectations? And that could be contributing to why they're ineffective. Yeah.
Well, given that there's this big muddle, it's so good we've got researchers to come and sort it all out. And obviously your research on future-oriented emotions and emotion regulation is going to be a large part of that. So thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Psych Talks with me, Nick Haslam, and Cassie Haywood. Huge thanks to our guest today, Dr. Ella Moak. This episode was produced by Carly Godden with production assistance from Louise Sheedy. Our sound engineer was David Carf. We always include links to extra materials in our show notes. And of course, you can find more episodes of Psych Talks from wherever you get your podcasts.